Ascent Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Deal Junkie, a half century of deals that brought the biggest U.S. retail and apparel companies to answer the moment and prepare for the future. By Gilbert Harrison. Narrated by Peter Lerman. Publisher's note, in this audio edition, you may hear references to visual elements present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Introduction. A crisis of passion and a big bounce back. The Lehman Brothers boom, bust, and rebirth years. 14 years after starting my investment banking firm, Financo, I sold it to Shearson Lehman American Express. The year was 1985. An inauspicious sign at the start, my first day there was Stephen Schwartzman's last. I said to Stephen that morning, "Why are you leaving?" And he said to me, "Why are you coming?" Well, it should have been a terrific opportunity, from my time as a mid-sized dealmaker working primarily in Philadelphia to joining on as a managing director of what was then one of the premier firms in the world. I won't lie, I loved my office view. Lehman had just moved their offices from 55 Water Street to the World Financial Center, and I had a corner office looking out at the Statue of Liberty. My wife Shelley and I had just bought a pied-à-terre on 72nd and Madison, and we were going back and forth between our home in Philadelphia and the new apartment. New York was but a short ride on the Amtrak, but I had the luxury of a driver going back and forth during the weekdays, and weekends between the Big Apple and the City of Brotherly Love was not a problem. My driver was a fantastic person, very good to me over the years, and was also most helpful in bringing me from my Upper East Side apartment to my downtown office and then back uptown for client meetings, the headaches of gridlock notwithstanding. New York was not at its peak beauty back then. The city was coming through hard times. The whole country was. Reagan was about to become the next big thing in the White House. The excess that we generally associate with the 1980s, and in particular Wall Street, was nigh. And me? I was looking out each day at Lady Liberty, so moved up in the world. Being bought by Lehman, this was the epitome of success. Best of all, I would be able to start doing the very biggest mergers and acquisitions in the country. In fact, I was not unfamiliar with working on such kinds of deals. Financo had recently completed 2 major acquisitions. The first of these was the purchase of Hasbro for Milton Bradley for about $500 million. Perhaps you think a company like Milton Bradley is all barrel of monkeys, battleship, trouble, and operation. Well, it is those things. But while at the heights of its success and owning such games as Monopoly, buying Hasbro allowed it to grow significantly. The second deal was the sale of Brooks Fashion Stores to AEA Investors and Dilex Corporation, which at the time was one of Canada's largest retailers. This was another deal with a huge fee. Both deals were among the 10 largest deals of their yearly quarters. So my business was going strong. The mergers and acquisition market had gotten extremely hot. But this doesn't explain why Lehman had come knocking on my door. That story begins in 1983, when Michael Milken made his own approach to buy Financo. I had known Michael since he'd made his start in Philadelphia after getting his MBA at Wharton. One of my best friends was at Drexel Burnham, where Michael was a rising star, and through him we got to know each other very well. After some time, Michael became interested in retail and the cash flow coming from these companies, and he asked me if I would consider joining Drexel Burnham, either bringing Financo along with me or just coming along myself. It was intriguing, but I was concerned about the lifestyle in L.A. Their office would start its business day around 5 o'clock in the morning, and they would work until after the sun had set. Because of these demands, many of his people I knew were either having heart attacks, getting divorced, or both. I credit my wife Shelley for refusing to let me and our family go down that path. But I was still interested enough in a potential partnership with Drexel to speak with one of my closest friends on Wall Street, Peter Solomon, who was then the vice chairman of investment banking group at Shearson Lehman Hutton American Express. His advice to me was that instead of going over to Drexel, I should join Shearson Lehman to head their merchandising group, which included apparel, retail, footwear, and other consumer groups. And so I did. Despite all of the financial gain that had come with the sale of Financo, I had not sold to Lehman for the money, nor for the prestige, or the tickets to Wimbledon, and the flights on the Concorde. Although I must say, I did love those Concorde flights very much. But because a larger firm could give me more resources and bring me into the senior leagues to do the absolute biggest deals around. As previously noted, while I had orchestrated $500 million deals, the bulk of our business was still middle market transactions, which at the time ranged in value from $30 million to $100 million. But I wanted the ability to play in the big leagues and do something meaningful at the highest level. The thing is, I love deals. I love everything about them. The game, the interactions with people, the chase, the kill. I always have, going all the way back to those earliest deals hashed out in the living room between myself, my brother, my mother, and father during my childhood in 1950s New Haven, Connecticut. But let's not talk about those days quite yet. First, let me tell you how Lehman, in just a few short years, nearly snuffed out that love and drove me to do as Steve Schwartzman had done the day I had arrived at the company. Head for the door. Now, maybe you recall that Lehman Brothers went bust in September of 2008. I don't think anyone doesn't remember. Well, all the signs of a collapse were already in place when I arrived in the mid-1980s. You had the politics of the old Lehman Brothers, and you had the bureaucracy that came from their parent company, Shearson American Express. The infighting, envy, and divisions within the company's structure made it so that you were working not as a team, but against the people in your own office. Very few of the bankers shared information. There was very little camaraderie. The bankers, for instance, were all very hesitant about sharing deals, concerned that doing so would affect their bonuses. And so they wanted to work on everything themselves and bar anyone else from receiving what should have been their business. That made for a very difficult environment. My friend Daniel Good, who had also come to Lehman from another firm, was head of merchant banking at the time, and he explains it like this. Most new top-level recruits didn't see or appreciate these conflicts as they weren't apparent from the outside, but what should have been a comfortable and effective joint effort became a war zone over fee-sharing and credit for transactions. As a result, internal tumult ensued, and top management changed several times before stability was achieved. I hadn't seen any of it from the outside, no, but now that I was on the inside at Lehman, it was all disappointingly apparent. And then something happened that really took the bloom off the rose. You see, before I had come to Lehman, back when they were courting me, I had been told by them that Macy's was their longest, most important retail client. Naturally, I had long admired Macy's and greatly looked forward to working with them. But then, a month or so after my arrival, I learned that Macy's had picked Goldman Sachs as their advisor in their bid to go private. Why? The only reason that anyone could conclude was because they believed Lehman had become a second-rate firm. Have you ever seen Hitchcock's Vertigo? All of a sudden, that was me, with the office and the Statue of Liberty with it, all starting to spin around and around and around. You wanted answers as to how this had happened, but you couldn't get any from anyone. It wasn't the kind of thing people discussed. And for the company, of course, it was treated as easy come, easy go. But no, this was Macy's, and I had joined Lehman so I could work with just these sorts of juggernauts. It was painful, disillusioning, and it had me looking around the office, seriously doubting that this was the Lehman Brothers we all knew and revered. While it took time, in just 4 years, over half of Lehman's investment banking operating committee of 15 people had quit the company. 1, 2, 3, 4, 9. 9 of our 15 committee members. And they were some of the best investment bankers on Wall Street. If you've ever been in a work environment where, one after another, the people you work with start to leave the company, you know that it's very tough on morale, and it makes it difficult to do your job. You don't know who's going to be there next week or next month, and you're wondering all the while whether you too shouldn't leave. Although my compensation was substantial, more than ever, I hated going to work each day. And the fact was, I couldn't shake the Macy's fiasco. Its message was too strong, too clear. This company isn't what you thought it was when you signed up. You've got to get out. You've got to get the freedom to do what you do back. This isn't the place to grow. Who have you even become in this environment? I wasn't sure that I could even answer that question. With Financo Independent in Philadelphia, I had been clear about myself and my job and how to go about it. I had known who I was, and everyone around me had too. Now that feeling was gone. In fact, in Philadelphia, I was the big fish in a little pond. In New York and at Lehman, I was just another schlepper. But what was I going to do? Leaving Lehman wouldn't be easy, largely because I had signed a 5-year non-compete with them. 5 years. There was no chance I would survive out there on my own for so long without doing the business I loved to do. I had no intention of subjecting myself or my family to that kind of uncertainty. But then, desperation isn't the worst sauce. It gets a guy thinking hard, and it makes him scrappy. And it made me see an opportunity. At the time, I was working on 3 major deals. One was with Don Fisher, the founder and CEO of The Gap, exploring whether the company wanted to go private. The second was with Melville Corporation, which would become CVS in 1996, who was my biggest client at the time. We were working on 2 or 3 acquisitions for them. And the third was with Boston Stores, which was owned by the Swiss company Mus Frères, which was in the middle of acquiring Carson Peary Scott department stores based in Chicago. They'd been my clients even before I went to Lehman. So I went to Lehman and I made them an offer that they could have refused but didn't. I would leave the company but continue to work on these 3 deals until they were seen through to an end. We agreed to a fee splitting in case any of them should work out. And that was that. They let me walk. The non-compete was put to bed. And, get this, I even got my company name back. Yep, that's right. Financo was returned to its founder, me. How I had missed it. How grateful I was to be able to fly that flag again. It's true, you don't know what you've got until it's gone. Or else you've got to set your love free, and if it comes back to you, then you know it's real. Either way, I was back in the saddle again, my own, ready to return to the fun of doing deals. I was reinvigorated. My love of the deal, a love that began early in life, all came rushing back to me, my blood warm, my eyes wide open. Have you ever heard that story about the smart young boy who grows up to be President of the United States? Can you believe his mother, Bessie, was always disappointed that he wasn't a lawyer or a doctor? Thanksgiving comes, and he calls his mother up in Fort Lauderdale, and he says, "Ma, I want you to come to the White House for Thanksgiving." The mother is reluctant to accept her son's invitation. But he tells her that he's going to send a limo and Air Force One to pick her up and everything. Finally, she says yes. Thanksgiving morning, she's leaving the lobby of her building to get into the car to go to the airport. And Bessie's friends say to her, "Where are you going?" And Bessie says, "You know my son the doctor and my other son the lawyer? I'm going to visit their brother." Well, let's just say that this story applies to me and my parents, too. Lawyer? doctor. These were the options my mother and father offered me at the time of my birth. Of course, you can't always please your mom and dad, and even though I went to law school, I always knew I liked business. Indeed, I showed an early instinct and passion for it. I grew up 4 blocks from the Yale Bowl in New Haven, and my first job was selling programs before games. Get your program here. Program, program. That was me, a young boy in the freezing cold on a late autumn northeastern day with rosy cheeks and big brown eyes, holding up my product and waving it in the air to get anyone to bite. Although I'd have a hoarse throat at the end of a day's work and need a cup of warm hot chocolate, it was an enjoyable job. Best of all, I got into the games for free and was able to see the action. And wouldn't you know it, I learned that I liked a job that comped my tickets to sporting events. Each season, Yale played either Princeton or Harvard at the Yale Bowl, says my dear brother, Roger. The programs for those games were large and heavy and sold for $1, as opposed to 50 cents for the normal smaller programs for other Yale football games played in New Haven. The $1 programs were bulky, very big and heavy, but very profitable, as the commission on each program was around 40 cents each. That presented a large opportunity to make money, perhaps $150. At that time, a great amount for one afternoon of work. It was a solid start in business, but then the next year a friend came to me with a new angle on generating income. Selling programs was great fun, sure, but how about we go into the big time? Yes, the big time. I was intrigued. Well, this friend lived just across the street from the Yale Bowl, and he had worked it out with his parents that we could park cars in front of his house at $10 a car. $10 a car? Now this was a lot of money for a kid. And what percent did his parents want? 5%? 10%? They wanted nothing? Nothing at all? Just that their son and his friend could have a job and show some ingenuity? So yes, I took the promotion, and suddenly I was making a lot of money. Walking around New Haven in those days, it was great to have money in my pocket. I realized then that I liked being able to buy most anything I wanted when I wanted. And I hoped, knowing that everything had its limits, that when I grew up I wouldn't have it any other way. But what did I even want? I was a teenager living in my parents' home, safe and well cared for. My father had a chain of restaurants, bakeries, and candy stores in New Haven and around Connecticut called the House of Hasselbach, a block from the Yale University campus. You know that Norman Rockwell painting of the boy at the soda fountain? Okay, well, life inside the restaurant wasn't quite that serene, but you get the idea. It was what they like to call simpler times. We knew a lot of people in New Haven, and everybody knew us. Children and their mothers and fathers would come in for ice cream and apple pie. You could have a cheeseburger for 70 cents, a BLT for 50, a milkshake for 30. Of course, nothing was new, and that was a beautiful thing, just as we liked it. What should be new? What should change? This life was working well for everyone, it seemed. I worked behind the counter at the House of Hasselbach during school vacations, helping out with the business. My father was a wonderful and kind man, very generous, well-liked, but he was also the first person to turn me down on a deal and teach me just how hard it can be to see a potentially good deal sour. My father had the most wonderful homemade pastries and cakes coming out of his bakeries. Believe me, I ate my fair share, and they were outstanding, and I was called pleasantly plump as a result. People throughout New Haven and graduates of Yale all knew the quality of the product. Was he famous for it? Locally, yes, I would say he was exactly that. It occurred to me, however, that we could package and freeze his baked goods and begin selling them throughout the Northeast and maybe even to points south and west. Well, why not? We had this great big freezer where we used to make and store ice cream that had a lot of extra room inside it. We would only need to sell them in the store, package up the product in a spiffy box, and ship them off. I could already see my father's cakes and pastries in every supermarket in the country, on every table, in every mouth. But my father, blessed man, he looked at me and my mother, who was in support of my vision, and said, "I do not believe in frozen baked goods. If it's not fresh, it's no good." "Dad, I don't know. I think you ought to rethink this. I think this could mean big business." But he didn't see it, and neither my mother nor I could make him see it. Though my father took pride in watching my career grow and prosper, I believe that this early professional dispute between us explains why, to this very day, I still feel a certain amount of regret when offered a Sara Lee pound cake. My father was born and grew up in New Haven to parents who had emigrated from Russia. The family name is Hirschhauser, but when my father came through Ellis Island in 1888, the customs agent gave him the name Harrison, since it started with an H, and Benjamin Harrison was president. My grandfather was a grocer who made ends meet and provided a humble origin for my own father, his brother, and my grandmother in a place built on the shoulders of immigrants. On the other hand, my mother, Tressa Warner, was born and lived in New York City and led a very privileged life growing up in a grand apartment on 96th Street with a butler and a chauffeur. I was told that Cole Porter used to play at their dinner parties. Perhaps this is why my love of the good life feels almost to have been written into my DNA. My mother's family had emigrated from Germany around 1860 and might have been considered part of the "our crowd" old line of Jewish families with names like Sobel, Isaacs, Wolf, among others, and many with the first name of Gilbert. Her husband, my grandfather, was born in Romania and was a true entrepreneur, a millionaire two or three times over, who lost his fortune again and again. Initially, for instance, he was the largest importer of crystal glass into the U.S. Not bad, except that one day a machine was developed to press crystal, and my grandfather's millions of dollars worth of inventory was suddenly worth less than nothing. Then the Depression came, and like most everyone, the family was hit hard. Also at the same time, my mother's brother, Gilbert Warner, died of appendicitis at just 16, before the advent of penicillin. I was named after him and other ancestors. Though my mother had had her eyes set on Wellesley College, her application already in the mail, my grandparents insisted that she stay close to home and her grieving family. She was still able to enroll at Barnard College and finish her studies and get her diploma. She got a job as a secretary to one of the directors at Pepsi-Cola. She was very smart, industrious. Her boss used to have her put through his orders on Pepsi stock, and whenever she made the calls, she would buy one or two shares for herself, $5 here, $10 there. When she died at 97, she was sitting on more than $3 million in Pepsi stock. No one had any knowledge of her shrewd fiscal smarts. She had just been quietly putting a little away at a time. I did a cost analysis, providing for inflation, and calculated that she had spent 58 cents on average for those stocks, which sold at $68 each at the time of her death. So there was a real savvy to my mother that worked hand in hand with a conservative nature brought on by her father's financial losses and their effect. I did not want to go to Yale, where I would be labeled a townie, so I looked outside New Haven for school and was happy to be accepted at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, which was then and still remains the best undergraduate school of its kind. I majored in accounting. After graduating in 1962, I went to the School of Law at the University of Pennsylvania, where I had one of the great lessons of my young adult life. My father was going through some difficult times financially. He had invested money into a failed real estate deal and had also sold the restaurants. The family was struggling. For my mother, no question, fears of her own childhood and her father's financial ups and downs were weighing on her heavily. My parents had paid for my college, and the tuition for law school was up next. Necessarily, I had to start doing my share of work to, at the very least, relieve them of the financial burden of my living expenses. I was working at a travel agency in Philadelphia, and I began selling charter flights to Europe when affinity groups were just starting up. Using every connection I had with friends in schools around the Northeast, I drummed up interest in these trips to Europe. I spent a lot of time every day on the phone, reaching out to everyone I knew. Buy a flight to Europe. Have you been to Europe? It's heaven on earth. An American in Paris, that could be you. I sold 600 seats that first year, resulting in approximately $10,000 in income, an outlandish sum when you consider that 3 years later, in my first year of practicing law, my salary was $7,200. Now, I know what you're wondering. Law school is highly demanding, isn't it? That's what they say. But if I was making all of this money in the travel industry, how much time did I spend studying? When did I learn the law, and most importantly, the ability to think, which is essential in both law and life? The truth was, I was not doing much of the aforementioned, and at the end of the school year, I was called in by the dean of the law school, who informed me that I was flunking out, and that he knew all about my business activities. He said I had a choice. I could stop working in the travel business and get down to my studies, or I could leave the school. This was a difficult decision, and not only because I was making more money than I could have ever dreamed. My family was not out of the woods yet as far as their own financial troubles were concerned. On the other hand, maybe it was time to tighten my own belt and scale back my entrepreneurial ambitions for the long game ahead. I had a whole life before me, and having a law degree was going to make that life, especially as it pertained to my hopes in a career of business, that much more successful. To have to pull back on a pursuit that was working out better than I could have ever hoped to better prepare for the marathon to come wasn't easy. It took that dean at the law school to bring it to my attention. I was just a young man. I needed that kind of guidance, the intellect of an experienced person to help show me that one step back can often mean two steps forward. I therefore made the decision to end my foray in the travel industry and continue on with my law studies, and when I graduated, I was in the top 10% of my class. In 1965, I graduated law school and joined Bermelstein, Burns, and Lesser, a Park Avenue law firm in New York. My law work required long hours. I loved the people part of the law more than the legal side, but I dove in and worked primarily on mergers and acquisitions, as well as other corporate work. I remember when the owner of the footwear retailer we represented, known as Shoetown Stores, decided to be sold. Shoetown had 42 stores, and my task was to update 42 different minute books, as in those days each store was a separate corporation, a process done to save on taxes. I also had to work with the landlords to assign the leases to the new buyer, and this was all very time-consuming. However, a week before the closing, the owner of Shoetown made a new call. That was, "Forget it, we are not selling." So my next job was to reverse everything I had done with respect to the minute books and leases. What a headache. But it's important to remember where your professional life began. As you will learn later in this book, Lionel Levy, the owner of Shoetown, would become a great client for whom we would sell Shoetown three times. Skipping ahead, in 1971, while practicing law in Philadelphia at Blank Rome, the lawyer in the office next to me was Stephen Klein. He and I became very close friends. In discussing our futures, we recognized that we both loved the clients we met day in, day out, and enjoyed the negotiations of any deal, but that love did not extend to the legal work involved. I don't think either one of us was enamored with the law practice.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?